Hello and welcome to Imperial College Business School's podcast, Inside Out, with your host Varun Bakshi. Inside Out focuses on ideas, academic work and perspectives within the business school and how all of that relates to the world outside. I'm joined today by Laure Dupreux, Assistant Professor of Economics at Imperial College Business School, whose research work lies at the intersection of healthcare and the environment, something that's incredibly pertinent today. I hope you enjoy this conversation. Let's listen in. Laure, so happy to have you on the podcast. How are you?
Good, and you? Thank you for having me.
Our pleasure. It's always interesting to dive into different conversations. And the reason I've been so intrigued to have you is because your line of work is at the intersection of healthcare and environmental economics. And this is so pertinent today, given that global warming and COVID-19 are two of the biggest issues that the world faces. What got you interested in healthcare and environmental economics?
Oh, I think that's something that attracted me long time ago already. I had this feeling from a very long age that individuals should benefit. They have the right, anyone had the right to benefit from a certain level of health. And at the same time, I just felt that, you know, we also have the right to benefit from a clean environment. And I did consider doing medicine, but I just didn't like the idea of blood and this kind of thing. So I pursued economics, and then I did health economics, and I realized that there was a need to do also environmental economics, and there was a great opportunity to combine both. So I've been looking at health-related question, the determinant of health, and how the healthcare system works, what can improve it. I've been looking at climate change-related policies, so really at the environmental environmental side, but also now I'm trying to look at the intersection of what's the impact, for example, of environmental policies and their impact on health outcome and individuals. And I have a keen interest in understanding really the inequalities around those two aspects. So inequalities in terms of health, the determinant of health, but also inequalities or environmental justice issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's so much to unpack there, but I think what's pertinent today is that, you know, although there's a healthcare crisis, the environment is almost thanking us because global warming has taken a backseat. Also, you know, pollution levels are so much lesser now.
People think it's so much. I think many people have seen those satellite images from Asia where we see a reduction in emission. But I think overall, it's not that large, and economic activity is still, you know, ongoing. Even though firms have had to reduce their activities, we still see some sort of activities, and emissions are not as low as people would guess, right? We have the impression everything stopped and the air is really clean. First, the air doesn't clear out that quickly. So if you think of particulate matters, they are still in the air. It's a result of different determinants. Some are brought from international sources. Some are natural. So it's not just because we stopped our economic activity or reduce our economic activity that we see a massive drop. But I think it's definitely an opportunity now for the future to think about what we can improve. People have had a taste of what it means to have, for example, London with less traffic, and you know, what can we do about it now and in the future? And a lot of people have been discussing the benefit of having a green recovery, and I think this is a very sensible move.
Mm-hmm. You know, we spoke about healthcare and environmental economics, and I'd like to unpack this a bit. And before I do, I'd preface this by saying air pollution is responsible for 5% of deaths worldwide and an estimated 40,000 premature deaths in the UK. And this leads us into your research paper, which is estimating the cost of air pollution to the NHS and social care, where you forecast all the way up until 2035. You've, in essence, quantified healthcare costs of air pollution within the UK, which is a first of its kind in this research. Can you walk us through this, please?
Yes, absolutely. So I'm delighted that you've been looking at the overall burden of premature disease in the world and in the UK. I think these numbers are overall large. And this study in the past have really focused on premature deaths. And in a way, while these numbers are big and impressive and should encourage us to change things, I think they kind of underestimate what would be the benefit of having cleaner air. Because if you think in terms of premature mortality, a premature mortality for the healthcare system is actually the savings, if you want, right? So people will die prematurely from air pollution. So in terms of the NHS budget, it doesn't have a direct impact. So what we wanted to do in this project was to also show and quantify what is the monetary impact of air pollution on the NHS. And it's a very modest project if you compare it to the overall burden of pollution on a health outcome. But we just thought, okay, let's just start somewhere and show that there is significant cost that is associated to not only premature mortality, but also some morbidity. So what we did, we joined forces with people who are specialized in microsimulation with epidemiologists, and we took very granular map of pollution concentration for the UK. So that gave us a sense of where are, if you want, the pollution pockets. And we mapped it to population characteristics, because you want to know not only where it's polluted, but also where people live in order to understand how people are exposed to air pollution. And then we looked at, I think it was 7 or 8 different diseases. We looked at asthma, COPD, coronary heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and lung cancer, for which we have, if you want, approved number in terms of how pollution is affecting those health outcomes. And then we just put it all together. So we had this pollution concentration for the whole UK. We had prevalence of this disease, but at a very fine geographical scale. And then we modeled what would be the impact over the next 20 years of having first a statu quo, so no changes in terms of air pollution, how that would impact the underlying population, how it is it likely to increase the different type of morbidities. And then we attach to those cases a cost. So that gives us the opportunity to calculate what will be the cost burden associated with those morbidities. And we estimated that the overall impact over the next 18 years of simulation would be roughly around 18 billion, which sounds like a lot at the individual level. But now if you put it in perspective to what is the NHS budget, I was just looking that up before we had our conversation, annually it's about 140 billion. So it's actually, it seems to be a small number, but nevertheless, it will be a savings. If we can address the problem of pollution, this is what the NHS should anticipate only for those diseases. And it's a lower bound estimate because we only focus on the disease for which we know that there is a causal effect between pollution and health outcome. But we also know that the impact of pollution on individuals is likely to be much larger, right? It affects productivity, it affects other type of disease that we were not able to account for. So it was just to encourage government and to identify, you know, what would be the minimum savings in a way that could be expected if we are able to improve air quality.
How long was this study undertaken? Because if you're saying that there are, you know, 40,000 premature deaths in the UK, how long was the research undertaken for you to attribute that these were the deaths thanks to air pollution?
So in this case, it wasn't death, it was actually morbidity. So we didn't consider death. So cost would have been much larger had we considered death. But I really didn't want to consider premature death in that case, because it raised a question in terms of how can you monetize a premature death, right? And this is less tangible, whereas the direct effect on the NHS is perfectly tangible. If you have one additional case related to asthma, you know exactly how much it costs. So it's easier to communicate to the government to say, okay, if you reduce pollution, you're going to have excess admission. This admission costs Y, and this is how much you're going to save by reducing air pollution. When you say, you know, when you say to government, pollution is affecting mortality and we have millions of people that are dying prematurely, the direct benefit of making sure that those people don't die the monetary value is not really clear, right? Because you have to quantify to monetize what would be additional life years at the end of people's life, right? So then there is a whole debate in terms of how much it costs, how much you value it. And I didn't want to get lost into this debate. So I wanted to have concrete numbers in terms of, you know, the exact number of admissions that we can expect and how much they are worth.
Right. I think it's also one of those things where when you have prolonged issues, it almost loses relevancy because COVID is so topical, because it's affecting each and every one of us, the issues come to light. But I mean, this is an issue, air pollution is an issue that's ongoing, that faces us every day, and yet we somehow overlook it completely. And it's not just the NHS or the UK, it's the world over, where we haven't taken collective responsibility in tackling this issue that we face on a day-to-day basis.
But that might be because it's hard to assess what's a direct benefit of reducing air pollution. Because when we tell government that reducing air pollution would avoid us X number of premature deaths, what is the exact benefit for the government? They have less people dying, but those people are likely to be old, to suffer from some sort of morbidities. So they don't have a direct benefit. Whereas if we are able to quantify what's a direct benefit for government, if we could quantify the direct productivity improvement, for example, associated with improved air quality, I think that would make things a little bit more tangible for government. And that's one thing that I'm trying to illustrate with my students, and when we're looking at specific cases, in the past I've been involved in a large refurbishment project in central London, and I got involved because I was looking at the environmental impact assessment, and they had done an environmental impact assessment because by law they are required to do one. And on the first page they were describing what they had omitted from their environmental impact assessment. And they had omitted like flooding risk, which I think it's very in central London, there are not too many risks related to flooding. They had omitted climate change, we could argue whether that was sensible or not, but they had omitted health impact. And I was horrified because a large redevelopment project in an area where we have pollution levels that are already above the legal limits, any big development project that will increase traffic, increase population density, we need to take into account the impact on air pollution and therefore the impact on health. And because this project was not large enough to do a proper health impact assessment, they just say we don't look at their health impact. And when you do that, you basically assume that the health impact is therefore zero. So you're looking at all the benefits, you're saying, you know, it increases the number of jobs in central London, it was attached to affordable housing, which is definitely a good thing. But then you don't look on the negative side. What would be the health impact?
Mm-hmm. It's great that you've spoken of government and the role they play. And I want to get your views on the policy implementation cycle, so listeners have a good understanding. The research that we spoke about earlier was in 2018, and it's been 2 years since then. How long does something such as that take to be implemented and for society to actually reap benefits of a policy that's you know positively impacting society?
Well, impact is what we are all trying to achieve, but it's a very long-term process, and we might do research that will never have an impact, right? So the political cycle is, you know, there is not one way. It's about having the research published in a good journal to show it's relying on strong evidence. Then it's about disseminating our research. So it's reaching out to the public, it's reaching out to policymakers. And then there is a little bit of a luck element, right? Because it has to be relevant for whatever they're trying to achieve. So unfortunately, a lot of what we do never ends up in making a change in the law. And I don't think that, you know, our research on the impact of pollution on the healthcare system had a direct impact on government guidance or policies so far. So we try to promote this work. We try to communicate it. It's going to be used as additional evidence to reduce air pollution. But in terms of whether it has changed any law in terms of traffic or any other pollution source, unfortunately, I don't think it has so far.
Do you think we've reached a stage where the world does need to take that step back? Because we've made tremendous progress over the last 70, 80, 100 years, right? Where there's been incredible levels of development, incredible value that's been created for economies the world over. But evidently, the environmental impact now is starting to become greater and greater.
You know, I don't like to make generality, but it's clear that, you know, some people have argued that pollution is a necessary harm until we grow enough so that we can reduce our emissions. And this is related closely to the Kuznet curve that was proposed to describe economic development. And the idea was that you need, while a country is growing and income is growing per individual, it will at the beginning create some inequalities because you need workers that are working a lot in order to develop some economic good. And when you reach a certain level of development, you can start decreasing those inequalities. And that was what the Kuznet curve was showing, is that these inequalities will increase up to a point. And when we keep growing, we will be able to reduce those inequalities. And some people have used this idea to describe pollution, saying that pollution has to take place, we need to grow and develop our technology, and there will be this magic turning point where we can keep growing and now start reducing our emissions. And I think a lot of environmental economists have argued against that, because it's a little bit, it's kind of suggests that we can just keep growing and the time will come by itself, this magic turning point where we will be efficient enough and our emission will reduce. And when it comes to greenhouse gases, but also pollutants directly impacting health outcomes, we've seen that, you know, we can keep growing, but we can innovate and we can force this turning point to come sooner, right? And improve our technology, but without impacting the environment as much as we used to.
Very interesting. I hope there's a magic solution, but I think there's consistent work that's required in this process either way. But maybe that's for another time. I want to also talk about another research paper of yours, which talks about inequalities in exposure to nitrogen dioxide in parks and playgrounds in Greater London, which highlights how deprived sections of society, and specifically children in this case, are exposed to worse quality of air. Now, this is pertinent because it's akin to what has played out with COVID, where those from deprived parts of the UK have had a more than double death rate compared to those from richer parts. What is the impact of something such as this, and how can we fundamentally turn this on its head?
I think it's really nice that you've related the two. So we had this research on park, which is very simple, and that's often the best way to communicate results to a policymaker. We had this level of nitrogen dioxide at a very disaggregated level for a Greater London. And we just thought, okay, let's do very descriptive analysis. So there is no modeling involved, no assumptions behind this. It makes things very simple because then no one can really criticize it by saying, you know, it's all due to our assumptions. So we did this very simple work where we took nitrogen dioxide emissions and we map all the open spaces in Greater London. And the first thing that we saw is that we had too many open space that were still providing an air quality that was above the legal limit in terms of air pollution. So suggesting that actually being outdoor in those spaces is harmful to health. And the numbers are quite large. Just to cite just a few, we had 24% of the spaces or 67 of private parks that were above the legal limits in terms of nitrogen dioxide. So this is quite worrying, but what was even worse is that then we started looking at where children live and what would be their closest park. So that will allow us to proxy the number of children accessing each park. And what we saw is that actually 14% of children within Greater London had access to parks that were polluted, you know, if you want. 14% of those of all the children had access to parks that had level of NO2 concentration above the legal limits. But what's more, even more worrying is among those 14% children, 66% of them were deprived. So people from poor family backgrounds.
Sorry to interject, but just for those who are listening in, how do you arrive at the statement where a child is from a deprived background?
Ah, very good point. So we also mapped, the Office for National Statistics has those figures at the postcode level or at a small geographical area. So we know compared in the entire population where on average people living in this area are in the distribution of income and the distribution of health and the distribution of healthcare access. So that's allow us, if you want, to rank area by the poorest on average to the richest, right? And right. So we don't have...
Right, you have a fair idea of what their income looks like.
Yes, on average by area. So of course you have some variation within those local area, but the local area are relatively small. I think it's about 1,500 people. So that gives you a sense of whether people living there tend to be poor or tend to be rich. It's like if you were ranking people from 0 to 100, right? So from the most deprived to the least deprived. And so you have then, if you want, a score of deprivation by area. And then you can see individuals living in those area tend to be more likely to access parks that are also more polluted. And this is exactly what we found.
Right. So how can we fundamentally change this?
Well, I think, you know, the point here was really to raise awareness among our policymaker because, you know, we tend to promote access and we tend to promote activity and open air, which is still good. It still outweighed the benefit, the damage of air pollution. It's still better to go exercising outdoor, even if it's polluted, because you really benefit from physical activity. But now to change it is really to flag that to policymaker and to suggest that we need to put in place policies that directly target sources of pollution in those areas. So my guess, and this is something we haven't looked in the research, so it's only a guess, is that, you know, traffic might be more dense in those poorer neighborhoods. We know that people who live in more polluted area tend to have a lower income, lower health, and, you know, it might be area which have high traffic levels and so on. So we really need policymakers to focus on those areas and try to improve either by providing public transport system, by regulating more traffic, providing cycling lane or whatever, or encouraging people to walk to school and so on, in order to reduce those sources of emissions that are polluting the air.
Mm-hmm. I mean, all of what we've spoken gives us perspective on how to look at healthcare differently, right? Ideally, as a society, you'd want lesser people falling sick, which translates into lesser money being spent on healthcare if the investment is made in the consistent well-being of a society. So you've spoken about having parks and encouraging a more active lifestyle. And if that investment is made rigorously over years, you hopefully will burden your healthcare systems lesser, or, you know, potentially there's a day where you could see a cut in healthcare spending or investment.
Yes, so that's exactly where, you know, we go back to the very first question you had for me on our research on the impact of pollution and the NHS. So if the government is able to reduce air pollution, it will have an impact on the health of the population and therefore reduce the demand of healthcare, right? And that's it's an interesting point you're making, because some people have suggested that it should be part of prevention. So reducing air pollution should be considered as one of the prevention strategy from the government, not only looking at obesity, but also, for example, air pollution. And ironically, the healthcare system is one of the largest polluter or largest polluting industry, right? I was looking at some figures. I think 5% of road traffic has been associated with NHS, either it's coming from people going to a hospital or anything that, you know, any emergency service that's going to the hospital. The healthcare system is also one of the largest emitters of greenhouse gases. And so the NHS will really benefit by taking the lead and showing the example and reducing their emission, thinking in terms of waste management, how can they improve things, not only reduce their waste and recycle, but also consider more efficient procurement methods. They need to think in terms of their heating systems. And, you know, they could take the lead because, ironically, they should be the one who are directly benefiting from a reduced amount of emissions.
Okay, I want to wrap this up, Laura, as tradition, by asking you to recommend to our listeners one book, any one book that you are currently reading or have read in the recent past that you'd recommend.
So I didn't have a chance to read much in the last 5 years because I had three kids, which were taking a lot of my free time. But the book that I have finally finished was Sapiens, A Brief History of Humankind. I think it's by Yuval Noah Harari, which is a significant piece, but was really extremely interesting.
That is a very fascinating book. And if you're listening in and haven't read that book, please do go check it out because it also has another part to it, which is Homo Deus. This brings us to a wrap. I'll see you in the next one.